everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our ongoing series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, the topic, the deterioration of democracy in America, the loss of our liberties, and how the nation's 25-year trajectory of folly brought us the presidency of Donald Trump, or would have given us the present of Hillary Clinton. My guest from New York City is Lewis Lapham. He is an American legend as a historian, essayist, author. He's the editor emeritus of Harper's Magazine and founder of Lapham's Quarterly, a quarterly publication about history and literature. He was the host and author of PBS series America's Century and host of the weekly PBS series Bookmark. He also produced the World in Time radio program on Bloomberg Radio. His documentary film, The American Ruling Class, has received wide attention. Lewis has received many awards, including the Thomas Paine Journalism Award, and he's a member of the American Society of Magazine Editors Hall of Fame. He's been compared with other great American essayists such as Mark Twain, I.F. Stone, Mencken, Gore Vidal, and others. He's published 14 books, his latest being Age of Folly, America Abandons Its Democracy. A 25-year adventure in American politics has brought us to the Trump White House. His website is laphamsquarterly.org. Nice to have you with us today.
I'm glad to be here, Gary.
I would like to pick up where we ended the last time on our noon broadcast on December 15th. You are also, in many ways, a classicist, besides being a historian. And unfortunately, at least my personal perspective, the American public has an allergy against learning from our past and taking to heart the insights of great classical minds. You've referred to Aristotle's evolution, or devolution, as it were, of political systems, describing it as a change of seasons. You describe fourfold consequence. According to Aristotle, monarchy dissolves into despotism, and despotism is overthrown by democracy. Democracy degenerates into plutocracy, and plutocracy then promotes a return to monarchy. So surely we're now at the third stage, with a chance of Trump taking on a monarch statue. We are going to have the most entrenched Washington cabinet of elite wealthy plutocrats in American history. And one of my deep concerns is that although these people have mastered the rules of capitalism, they are clueless and are abjectly ignorant about real politics, diplomacy, facing the deep moral and ethical challenges necessary for a just governance and rule of law. They are living in bubbles, gold leaf bubbles. They do not on any level communicate or associate with the average American. The only time you will ever see any of these people in a common environment, like a coal mine towel or Cheyenne, Wyoming, would be when they're on a political campaign and it's necessary to show that you care about the so-called little people. There is a line from the great Christian monk and social activist Father Thomas Merton that is revealing. He said, "The hubris of affluence and power and the communion of arrogance make czars out of mice." And I can't think of a more bizarre mouse with small paws who would be czar now about to enter the White House. So please begin with explaining to us where we are now within Aristotle's timeline of political seasons. And also, we might not use the word monarchy today. What would be the alternative or equivalent that we might be facing following plutocracy? The form is yours.
Well, I guess the word would probably be tyranny or fascism with a smiley face. The a dictatorship of some form or another, an imperator, as the ancient Romans called it. I mean, go back to Aristotle. He says that all government, no matter what form it takes, is the means by which a privileged few arrange the distribution of property and law to the less fortunate many. It's an oligarchy, and its lifespan depends on the character of the men charged with the management of its moral, political, and economic enterprise. Over time, however, oligarchies bear an unhappy resemblance to cheese. Sooner or later, they turn rancid in the sun, wealth accumulates, men decay, and a band of brothers that once might have aspired to forming a wise and just government acquires the texture of what Aristotle likened to that of a prosperous fool, a class of men so besotted by their faith in money that they therefore imagine there is nothing it cannot buy. And they get afflicted with it. The Greeks had a word for the illness of this prosperous fool, and they called it pleonexia, the unbridled appetite for more. More laurel wreaths and naval victories, more banquets, dancing girls, and mirrors. And the fatted calves forget why sovereign nations go to war or how it comes to pass that money doesn't grow on trees. And that's what we, at least in my view or an opinion, have on hand in Washington. I mean, a government of prosperous fools. And the founders of the American Republic understood Aristotle's sequence, and they understood that what they were setting up was an oligarchy, but that was an oligarchy that depended on the character of the men in charge. And according to Madison, what they had was, among the people signing the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, men with who were prosperous, I mean, men of property, who had, Madison's words, the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue the common good of the society. And this was an assumption shared not only by Hamilton, but also by Jefferson. I mean, they have an argument about the bank, and they argue with Madison, they argue with Aaron Burr, but and the politics in the United States in the 1790s is very contentious. I mean, the press is even more scurrilous around the election of 1800 than it is now. The country was divided into the faction of the Federalists on the one hand, Washington and Adams, on the other hand, the what were then called the Republicans, which was Jefferson, and people were throwing stones at each other in the streets of Philadelphia. The Republicans were wearing French Revolutionary red caps, and the Federalists were wearing black top hats, and they were very there was violence. People would attack each other, and the accusatory slanders in the press, in the press loyal to Jefferson and the press loyal to the Federalist, was extremely bitter. So, but the founders understood that the task that the men in the oligarchy, the men in charge of the government, it required constant tinkering. I mean, you had to keep working at it. You couldn't just imagine that you had inherited it. Freedom had to be won every day. I mean, it was not a trust fund. And the oligarchy that they envisioned, they called a republic, and it was an attempt to balance the spirit of a democratic society. Americans, we are and have been a democratic society, and that works according to the motions of the heart. But you had to be able to balance that with the movements of a market, which is capitalism. I mean, capitalism, principle is, you know, buy cheap, sell dear, more for me, less for you. It's not the same as the democratic idea in which all men are more or less equal before the law, if not in intrinsic talent, at least in opportunity and possibility.
George Bush Jr. and the Iraq episode.
Yeah.
The U.S. increasingly betrayed our domestic economic policies and replaced it with a war economy.
Well, we started that, actually. I'm sorry, Gary, but we began to develop a war economy right after World War II in 1948. And the George Kennan, who was then a leading diplomat and a very influential thinker within American circles of power, said it very simply in I believe, 1948 or 49. He said, the United States has 5% of the world's population and 50% of the world's wealth, and we mean to keep it that way. And you remember that when he was leaving office, Eisenhower in 1956 warned against the military-industrial complex that was taking over the running of the government. And not in 1956, 1960. But it was clear right then. And the Cold War was a raison d'etat for 9 American presidents. It was the reason for, it was the great funder of the war against the Russians was the what kept the military industrial complex in funds, and it the money distributed throughout the society as some sort of a military installation in every state in the Union, and the building up of a national security state was providing the funds for the inflation of, you know, the conspicuous consumptions of the American dream. And then they have a real problem. Suddenly in 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. Reagan and Gorbachev reach an agreement to quit the arms race because the Russians could no longer afford it. But now, where is the enemy? Where is the world-class operatic enemy that our definition of ourselves increasingly has come to depend upon? And how do we have this magnificent military apparatus, I mean, weapons of every conceivable caliber, I mean, naval ships at every point of the compass, military bases in God knows how many countries in the world. I mean, I think at one point we had as many as 700 military bases scattered around the world. We may still have, as far as I know. But what's it for? What's the strategic purpose? I mean, who's the target? Where? I mean, why? And so in 1993, the Bush administration, first Bush, H.W., they come up with what they call the defense strategy for the 1990s, which is the doctrine of forward deterrence, anticipatory self-defense, and preemptive strike. And this is a document written by Cheney, who was then the Secretary of Defense, and Colin Powell, who was then the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And the idea was to have a military ensemble that was capable of fighting two major wars on two continents simultaneously, and at the same time making sure, you know, taking care of terrorism in the slums of the Middle East and the jungles of Africa and the mountains of Colombia. And over the course of the 1990s, through the, you know, with the full support of the Clinton administration for 8 years, that enrichment of the Pentagon subsidy takes on the character of the idea to rule and save the world. And we get the idea of the American empire, which becomes very much of the mind in the Washington consensus in the late 19, so much so that in March 2001, 6 months before the attack on the Trade Towers, Time magazine comes out with the announcement from Charles Krauthammer, one of the leading voices of American empire, that America is the indispensable nation, and the greatest power on earth since Rome, free to create its own reality, to do as it pleases, and other nations of the earth simply must accept their inferior and subsidiary status. And God forbid that they should try to challenge the moral, military, and economic supremacy of the United States, because if they dared to do so, the United States would crush the impudence at birth. That's where we were at when the Trade Towers came down. I mean, it was delusionary, but the consensus in Washington has been delusionary for, you know, a very long time. It's true that at the end of the Cold War, the end of World War II, 1945, the America was the supreme power in the world, not only militarily, but also economically and also morally. I mean, we had fought on the side of good against the side of evil, against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And the Roosevelt Doctrine of the Four Freedoms was a light in the darkness, a bright and shining torch, which led among other things, the Marshall Plan, the rebuilding of Europe. But we were not the same nation in the year 2000, but the Washington consensus wished to believe so. It thought that it had omniscient omnipotence, that it had the wisdom to shape, not only the wisdom, but also the power to shape the way of the world. And that was a serious delusion, and which got shattered at the, you know, on 9/11, which led us into the, which led the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, into the war on terror, which is a hopeless war. You cannot win a war on terror because that's a war against a, an unknown enemy and an abstract noun. That's like a war on poverty or a war on drugs. It's the wrong way to think about it. And we actually thought, or I think the Bush administration actually thought, that it could bring democracy and the American way of life to the Middle East. That was a delusion.
I would like, Lewis, I'd like to quote Norman Cousins. Did you know Norman?
I did, briefly. I met him a couple of times. He was just, he was going away from, you know, he was leaving at the end of his career at Saturday Review when I was beginning my career as the editor of Harper's Magazine.
Mm-hmm. I would meet him early on. I did a radio program before my health program called Writers Forum, which he appeared on. But later, a friend of his asked would I help based upon his, what was considered medically irreversible condition. And that's when he wrote his book on the importance of laughter and finding hope. He said, the human body experiences a powerful gravitational pull in the direction of hope. That is why the patient's hopes are the physician's secret weapon. They are the hidden ingredients in any prescription. So when we look at today and we see people did not have hope during the Bush-Cheney era. They, I don't believe they had hope during the first Clinton administration, both Bill and Hillary, co-presidents. But I believe Barack Obama really emphasized the whole idea of hope because so many people were suffering. And outside of election cycles, no one was doing anything to help them. So when you look at the world today, and if you are the average person, you don't have $500 in savings. You have over $36,000 in debts, car debt, not including mortgage on a home, not including your college debt, but credit cards. And you don't see any way out of this. So isn't it on one level understandable that people who have nothing to lose and have seen where one administration after the other for the last 32 years have betrayed them? All they have left is hope. So whoever exaggerates the potential of what they can do, then they become the person that people are gravitated to. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's the strength of the Trump's campaign. I mean, I'm going to make America great again. But that was actually the same kind of platform that Reagan ran on in 1980. Reagan came on, if you remember, the late 70s is a period during the Carter administration, you know, American malaise and anxiety and despair. And they're, Carter wearing sweaters and keeping the lights off in the White House and saying that we have to, that the country is in terrible trouble and we have to cut back and practice, damp down our standards of living. And Reagan comes on, I mean, full of hope. I mean, that was... that was his whole pitch. I mean, I don't think he actually used the phrase "America great again," but it was, in all to all intents and purposes, that was his message. And if you remember the night before his inauguration and at the convention center in Maryland, I mean, there was a party given for him by on stage by Frank Sinatra, and the people and there is Reagan and Nancy Reagan seated center stage and thrown like armchairs, and it's a Hollywood musical. I mean, you have Jimmy Stewart shows up in his uniform. I mean, his Air Force General's uniform, and you have Bob Hope and Johnny Carson and Frank Sinatra singing "America the Beautiful," and it was a very kind of Hollywood musical, optimistic showboat evening. And so that, the expression of hope is always going to be stronger than despair. And people didn't, a lot of people didn't like Trump, and a lot of people thought he had very bad manners, and he was foul-mouthed and impolite. And there were a lot of things wrong about Trump as a candidate, but on the other hand, his attitude was a positive one: change and change for the better. And now you can say it was fraudulent. I mean, you can say that he's not going to be able to make good on any of his promises, but I mean, at least he was on that side of the aisle.
I'd like to redirect your attention for just a moment on something.
Yeah.
When we take a look back to this war economy we've been in, and none of these people visit the cities like Detroit and Camden, New Jersey, or Baltimore, or El Paso, or Fresno, and many others in the rural belt, Rust Belt. And for all intents and purposes, we could be visiting Berlin shortly after the Allied bombing at the closure of the Second World War, minus the destruction of the buildings, the dire sense of poverty, the hunger within our population. 16 million children go to bed hungry. 2.4 million children don't have a home to go to after school. So clearly the domestic economy is doing nothing for these cities or their inhabitants. You have 155 million Americans living just at, above, or below the poverty line. There is no hope for them. And so we can understand that, we can understand their pain. I've spent 5 years traveling to these places, talking with these people for a film I did called Poverty Inc. So I got to see what they're really about. And the idea that Hillary Clinton would lump all these people, or the rest of the liberal community would lump these people as white racist, you know, illiterates, anti-intellectual, they haven't been there. They're in a safe, ensconced environment. And I think it's a very big disservice to be castigating people that you do not know anything about. And so I think that I could understand a little better what people's anger is about. Now I want to take you back to something that ties us together. This goes back to the 1990s. And a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, her and her husband were going to be the primary advocates for Bill Clinton for presidency. And they were holding in their townhouse over on the east side a fundraiser and a kind of meet and greet for the Clintons. But I had already done a lot of research on Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton. I knew all about their background, something none of these people cared about. And after the evening, where I had a chance to meet some of New York's, and in fact, America, not just New York's, shakers, makers, the policymakers, and opinion leaders, heads of major corporations, heads of the media. And we had a whole afternoon just to talk about this. And here's what my friend said to me. Gary, you're being extremely naive. The people that you met last night and the people that we're going to introduce the Clintons to this weekend out at our East Hampton estate And there'll be about 400 people all told that we'll introduce them to over the next week or two. These are the leading liberal Democrats in New York, many in the entire country. Here's what you should be fully aware of. A, there's nothing historically liberal about them. These are not your FDR liberals. B, they're looking to see what can the Clintons do for their industries, for their business, for their stature. And they know that if they can get an appointment, they can go in for a little bit of time, help be in a government agency, oversee it, and then go back into a private industry. And that just helps her resume. It's all about bragging rights. It's all about positioning. Because all these people that you met, they're all rich beyond imagination. And so it has nothing in the world to do with about electing a person who best serves the interests of the environment or the people or the poor and downtrodden. And so you're going to be very, very disappointed in this presidency. But all of us already know what this presidency is going to be about. We know about the Clintons. We know about Hillary Clinton. She's going to run that whole operation. This is my friend who is, I might mention, one of the most astute but powerful women at that point in New York. And her husband, a major influence. So none of the people I was meeting, because I was very disappointed when I was asking just basic questions when we were socializing about, do you ever get out to see America? Why would I? Why should I? I see everything I want to see from the advantage point that I have spent my whole career getting to. And a lot of these were trust babies, baby boomers in their 50s, 40s. They never had to work a day in their life. And their idea of what America should be and is and will be under Clinton was based upon their own self-interest. If I just wish, it's one of those moments in my life where I thought, oh my goodness, if only I had a camera that nobody could see and a mic that could pick up these actual conversations, because these are the cultural leaders. These are the people in the magazines and the newspapers and the media, and they don't give a damn about anything except themselves. Wasn't it Voltaire who said, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is? And these people had no doubt about what could happen. And one of them said, you don't have to worry about controlling the Clintons. You don't need to. Because they're not going to do anything that's going to jeopardize their power base. And we are their power base. Your thoughts on that, please?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you read this book, the I actually have a whole scene exactly as you describe it. I mean, in the election of 1992, right? That's when Clinton comes.
Yes, 92.
Yeah, right. So the essays in this book, I mean, have been written over the period of the last 25 years. So there are essays from 1990, 1992, 1996, 2000, and up to the present. And one of the essays from 1992 is my account of being at a dinner party in New York with exactly these same kinds of people. And I don't name them by name, but I point out that they are columnists, they are, you know, hedge fund operators, they are people of means and privilege, and the whole conversation is what's in it for me? they don't know. I wrote a book in 1989 called Money and Class in America, where you already have the rich and the poor are living in utterly different worlds. They don't need government. They don't need, they don't care. They're rich enough to, you know, provide their own police, provide their own private schools, provide their own gated communities. That is happening big time in already in the late 80s. And I can remember I've been around a long time. I can remember not only in the 60s and the, even through the 70s. I can remember talking to people who of means and you know, the sort of, I mean, the division between rich and poor is nowhere near as wide in the late 70s as it is, as it had become by the late 80s. But in the 70s, I could still talk to people who, you know, in New York, the supposed liberals who actually knew the name of their congressman or knew how the government worked, knew what a caucus was, knew what a committee was, knew at least one or two of the articles of the Constitution. But by 1989, 90, I mean, there were people with that kind of knowledge and interest were very scarce on the ground. I mean, when I graduated...
And younger people non-existent today.
Yeah.
Younger people couldn't tell you anything about the true history of anything.
No. No, they don't have any idea how their government works. They ask from the government what the rich ask of their servants. Comfort us, tell us what to do. Give us our allowance.
Liberals and Democrats look upon the Clinton White House as having been a very liberal administration.
It was,
and
not.
Much of the media supported that. Yet, wasn't it under the Clinton years that we saw the concentration of wealth among the few exponentially grow? So what is your overall critique of Clintonian liberalism?
Well, it was plutocracy. I mean, it was on the road to the plutocracy. I mean, it's the line of development that I regard as the age of folly in America, abandoning its democracy. I mean, Clinton, if you remember Clinton's first inauguration, I mean, there was the wonderful show of democracy. I mean, he comes on a bus from Jefferson's estate in Monticello in Washington, and then there's some sort of ceremony at the Lincoln Memorial, and there are sentimental songs by Barbara Streisand and a poem from Maya Angelou and so on. And that's for show. That's democracy. That's, you know, that's the sham democracy, the one we put on for, you know, every 4 years when we have the Festival of Democracy, which is our sort of, you know, presidential campaign. And but at the same time, up on Capitol Hill, the people that are being appointed to the cabinet posts are very similar to the kind of people that are being appointed by Trump. You know, it's the status quo, it's the money interest, it's the, you know, it's the people that are going to take care of their friends.
I remember when Noam Chomsky was asked whether free market capitalism was compatible with democracy, and he stated absolutely not. And we could also say that concentrated power and wealth are absolutely incompatible with democracy as well. But how about religion, and in particular, fundamentalist brand of Christianity that is slated to dominate Trump's cabinet? The left-leaning Israeli newspaper Haaretz called Trump's White House picks a Christmas gift for the religious right. And, of course, there are more superstitious evangelical choices with his VP, Mike Pence, his educational secretary, Betsy DeVos, and Ben Carson, his pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt's only solution to dealing with climate change and global warming, is put faith in God, since God will handle everything regarding the environment in our favor. So sticking with this topic on the demise and folly of democracy in America today, how has the radical Christian right contributed to it?
Well, it contributed. If you remember, the late 70s. I mean, the church during, and I mean the church generally speaking. I mean the established Protestant Catholic churches in America are in the era of the New Deal during the Roosevelt administration and well into and through the 60s. Remember Coffin and the grass resistance at Yale and so on. But the religion comes with Jerry Falwell and the moral majority and the, I can't remember the names of all the people. You will, but I mean
Jimmy Swaggart.
Yeah, I mean they come around to the money side in the late 70s, and they're backers of the Reagan Resurgimento. I mean they're very much on the side of property. You lose. A democracy is about, really about virtue. To make it work, you have to have people that are concerned for their fellow men. Genuinely. I mean, like Walt Whitman, beautiful example, or Mark Twain, another. There are many people in our history that have this kind of feeling. I mean, the impoverished church is usually or has traditionally has been on the democratic side of the, which is also the Christian side of the democratic idea, but that shifted. In the late 70s, and the property church came over to the side of concentrated wealth.
Hmm. If we read the independent left and progressive news and opinion sources, there is indication that a revolution is underway, not covered in the mainstream media. There are revolutionary characteristics of both Trump and Sanders' successes because they threaten the Washington consensus and our corporate plutocracy, at least initially.
Yeah.
Clearly, we saw this at Standing Rock, which I applaud, as evidence of peaceful protest potential for progressive action, although that conflict is far from over after Trump's cabinet occupies its office spaces. Now, Occupy Wall Street was another revolutionary attempt, albeit a belief too chaotic, misinformed, and even rather self-congratulatory, and therefore not especially or even effective. In fact, I remember I went to so many of their meetings in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York, and Florida, and they had simply excluded with the finger the entire movements of the women's movement, the civil rights movement. If you were over 30 years of age, in the places I went, you were not welcome. When I said, there have been a lot of people who've sacrificed a lot prior to you coming here with your movement, and it seems like you've evolved into talking in unison and finding ways to hang out here in your little pup tents before you get thrown out, where we were actually, doing things at Columbia University and other major institutions to bring them to a halt so we could galvanize attention on the real issues, the context of the arguments. And it looks like the whole argument here is, will you have enough to eat? Will you be beaten? What about the major issues? And there was just a disconnect at every level. I was disappointed in it, quite frankly, though everyone else wants to pretend it was more significant than what it actually was. And when they say 1%, let me tell you something, 1% doesn't exist. It's a mythological quality. If you're talking about the most powerful people in the United States, you're talking about 10% of the population. You've got over 8 million millionaires, plus all those that work with those, the technocrats, the bureaucrats who work with them. So you're dealing with over 30 million people. That's not 1%. So changing a few of the billionaires' mind about anything is not going to change anything. You got to change a whole system, and we're not able to do that because we lack any construct of revolutionary theory today. So when you look at a true revolutionary spirit and understanding the absent from our body politics, then how are we supposed to have anything happen? And this is probably where it's most needed. So what is revolutionary theory, and what part of revolutionary theory has been lost from the Washington consciousness, the American consciousness, and how might national governance be different if it restored its revolutionary attitude? And finally, when you or myself or probably in the neighborhood of about 200,000 or 300,000 other baby boomers and some younger people have gone to demonstrations, and not just as a token effort, okay, I went, but it's a part of our life. And today, the biggest demonstration we can get going in the United States is one against the march against Monsanto. But outside of that, 99% of Americans don't protest anything, don't involve themselves in anything, will support everything that the mainstream throws at them. So we have to take a very honest look about how we have de-evolved as a nation on spiritual, social, humanistic, and actual levels. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, again, that's the story of the last 25 years, is the abandonment on the part of not only the powers that be in Washington and New York and so on, but also on the part of the electorate. The electorate is bought into the idea that only money counts. And that was one of the great strengths of the Trump campaign. Trump came down the escalator on June 16th, 2015, and said that I'm here because I'm to tell you that I'm really, really, really rich. And money, ladies and gentlemen, is power. And power is not self-sacrificing or democratic. And he was very upfront. I mean, he was upfront and fascist in his saying that democracy was a dead letter. I mean, it's the same thing that Brandeis said to Roosevelt in 1933. Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, says to Roosevelt at the outset of the New Deal in 1933, we must make our choice. We can have democracy, or we can have the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. We can't have both. And that's true. And Hillary Clinton and the limousine liberals that you talk about the ones in New York and, you know, in their bubble and in the Washington consensus, try to pretend that, yes, Virginia, we can have democracy and the concentration of wealth, and they can live happily ever after. The truth, and Trump comes along and says, I'm sorry, Justice Brandeis is right, and I'm here in favor of concentration of wealth. And the electorate over the last 25-odd years has been taught to believe the same thing. I mean, every politician, what have they been telling them? They've been saying, you're America's guests. You're entitled to everything, and so on, right?
Hmm. And, okay. Horace Greeley?
Yeah, I remember Horace Greeley.
Yeah. He said the darkest hour of any man's life is when he sits down to plan how to get money without earning it.
Yeah.
And we have an awful lot of those today.
Yeah.
As you know, there has been a lot of controversy over fake news during the past couple of weeks. And what actually defines fake news, when you were on the program earlier, you stated that since 1957, when you first started a career as a reporter in San Francisco, fake news and misinformation has been a part of the mainstream media industry, and your entire career, you said, had been intimately woven with the media. Instead of focusing on what is and is not fake news, what I feel is more important is the role the mainstream media has played in eroding America's democracy. It couldn't have happened without their cooperation or compromises. And are there any benchmarks or milestones you observed during the past 30 years in the history of mainstream media that you feel have led to the dismal state of the media and the modern journalistic state today?
I think the dismal state is the media beginning to take itself so seriously. I mean, the media is so self-glorifying. I mean, I'm talking about the mainstream media. I'm talking about the talking heads and the leading pundits and the, you know, the god-awful network talk shows and so on. I mean, the media has come to consider themselves an aristocracy of conscience. I mean, it's their insufferable self-promotion that is unbearable. I mean, when I first come into the media, I mean, as a newspaper reporter in the San Francisco Examiner in 1957. Essentially, the press was on the side of the people. It was representing the citizenry. It was the point of view from the bleachers. And then, over the course of the 60s, you get celebrity journalists, and journalism becomes more about themselves than about whatever it is that they're supposed to be looking at, and they identify with power. They, instead of speaking truth to power, they are explaining power to the powerless. And I don't know if you remember Tim Russert when he
sure,
and he was the worst. I mean, I'm sure he was a fine fellow and all that, but I mean, as a journalist, he was really a Rosencrantz, Guildenstern lickspittle, which was also true of Bob Woodward. The journalist, the media discredited itself because its pretensions overtook it. I mean, and the whole complaint about fake news is, and the media, you know, goes on and talking about itself, how we missed it, and so on. they're talking about themselves. I mean,
no irony there at all. Final question for you. You're recognized as a highly educated historian, so I have a philosophical question, because in my opinion, America exists in a fog of historical amnesia. For example, how many Americans could quote one of the great minds or literary figures in the past American history? How many even know about the great books of the Western world? Even those created, let's say, in the 1920s and forward, representing the foundational writings in literature and science and history and philosophy at the pinnacle of Western civilization's development over the millennia. Even Thomas Jefferson kept lists of great books to be read by his friends. Largely, our historical amnesia is a failure of our school system, but it's also a problem of the loss of critical thinking and a loss of our collective historical memory. And I would even say American mainstream journalism today suffers from this historical forgetfulness. So why, in your opinion, is history so important today?
Because it's an enormous resource of energy and hope to really learn the history of America is to find in it the story of a courageous people. There'd been a lot of, I mean, it's a very mixed story. I mean, the, you know, we eliminated the Indians not only in New England but also in on the Western prairies, and the elective war in Mexico in 1846 was the thing that got Thoreau castigated for civil disobedience, and even Abraham Lincoln as a congressman as a representative in Illinois was against the Mexican War. So the story is a very checkered one, but that is the story of all history. And unless we know, instead of trying to teach ourselves a fairy tale, we have to give it because it's only when we understand the dark side of our history that we can appreciate the achievement of the bright side, to understand at what odds civil rights have been achieved and so forth. I mean, it's a very dramatic story, and we don't teach it that way. And that's one problem. And the other problem is that with the electronic media, it makes it very hard to tell a coherent story, because the camera sees but doesn't think. The camera makes no moral or meaningful distinction between a bubble bath in Las Vegas staffed by pretty girls and a bloodbath in Palmyra staffed by headless corpses. They both draw on the bankable wells of emotion, the bottomless wells of ignorance, wish, dream, fear.
Lewis, powerful thoughts once again. I appreciate the new book, Age of Folly, America Abandons Its Democracy, and we look forward to our next conversation together.
Gary, I enjoy talking to you because you know more about this than I do, and it's a pleasure to learn from you.
Thank you very much. Lewis Lapham, one of the greatest legendary historians, essayists, and thinkers in America, and editor emeritus from Harper's Magazine. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying.